This session is What Do Socialists Say About Political Correctness, which is being presented by Corey Oakley, who's one of the editors of Red Flag newspaper. So Corey will speak for 30 minutes or so, and then we'll have time for questions and discussion. And just a reminder, if you want to get a meal after this and before the final rally, the food trucks will still be available out in Dodge Street. And the final session will start in the Grant Street Theatre, that's the Aqua Room, for those of you who've been going there, and that will start at 7:30, and hopefully everyone can come. The theme of this final discussion will be Global Rebellion in 2018, and some of our international guest speakers will be speaking at that. Okay, so we'll get underway. Take it away, Corey.
I want to start with an exchange between Donald Trump and Megyn Kelly that took place at one of the Republican debates during the presidential election in 2016. And Megyn Kelly, for people who don't know, was at that time one of the most prominent right-wing Fox News presenters and so on, hardly known for her feminist views. But she challenged Trump. She said, challenged Trump, saying, "You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals." And she was citing some of the things that had come out in the news just over the previous day or two. Trump's response to these demands to answer why he called women these things was to say, "I think the big problem this country has is being politically correct. I've been challenged by so many people, and I frankly don't have time for total political correctness. And to be honest with you, this country doesn't have time either." Now, Trump was fairly predictably cheered to the rafters for this response by the Trump supporters in the audience. That's not very surprising. But what is a little more surprising and concerning is if you see it in the context whereby one poll had it that as many as 80% of Americans agree with the proposition that political correctness is a serious problem in the United States. 80% of people. Now, that's not to say that 80% of people would have thought Trump's response in that instance was in any way valid, or that they supported him or endorsed him or a rampant sexist or whatever. But I think it does tell you that the left needs to take the question of the right's crusade against political correctness seriously, and to recognise that it's been, over a long period of time now, a quite powerful weapon in their hands. Now, attacks on political correctness, in my opinion, are a key part of the broader culture war that the right is waging. It says that the main divide in society is between progressively minded elites, usually in the inner cities, the inner suburbs of cities like Melbourne, but in the American context, New York, and so on, who are rich, well off, progressive on social issues, but basically unconcerned with the plight of the mass of people, and rich enough to not have to be able to concern themselves with policing language and so on, rather than have to worry about bread and butter economic concerns. So the battle of society is between them on the one hand, and then the masses on the other of workers who are downtrodden, economically exploited, and fundamentally conservative, politically nationalistic, racist, and so on, and don't have time for any of this political correct garbage. I think that broader culture war, of which political correctness is only a part, has really been the key ideological tool that the right wing has used over really the past three decades to campaign against centre-left parties like the Democrats in America, the ALP, and the Greens in a different way in Australia. And I think seeing it as a right-wing weapon is really important. You can have a narrower definition of what political correctness is, and it's probably the one that the right would put forward, is what they're saying. They say it's not partisan. They just say that opposition to political correctness is about opposing the ideological straitjacketing enforced by a political elite to police ordinary people's opinions to express their real views, and using everything from shaming and ostracisation of unpopular views to using institutions of social power to censor and punish transgressors. That's sort of what political correctness is about in terms of how the right conceives it. But I think if you only see it in those terms, without taking into account the broader partisan nature of it and the fact that it's used for the, by the right to attack the left pretty much exclusively, you can't really understand it. Because actually, by that definition that I just gave, well, actually, you have to say, in terms of political correctness here in Australia, what's the biggest imposition of political correctness? I'd say it's the all the fuss that's made every year around Anzac Day. And, you know, just to remind comrades a bit about how Anzac Day is portrayed and promoted, just wanted to quote from Marilyn Lake, who wrote a book about this with Henry Reynolds. And she explained how during the last 10 years, a veritable tidal wave of military history has engulfed our nation, generating a torrent of curriculum materials sent to primary and secondary schools by the Department of Veterans Affairs, the endless stories and supplements in newspapers and other media, new documentary series, live broadcasts of the Dawn Service from Gallipoli, travelling national and local museum exhibits, the Anzac Lecture Series, an exhibition at the Shrine of Remembrance in Melbourne, the expansion of memorials across the country, and the publication of an unprecedented number of books in the field of war history, often made possible by subsidies from the Department of Veteran Affairs. The vast pedagogical enterprise of the Department of Veterans Affairs, which under the Commemorative Activities Program has supplied all schools in Australia, primary and secondary, with voluminous and sophisticated curriculum materials, websites, virtual tours of the battlefield, handsome prizes including trips to Gallipoli and so on, has been made possible by massive funding from the federal government. So the Anzac Day, in terms of, you know, a politically charged event that is, you know, driven by public funding, promotion through, you know, all the institutions of power in society, you have to say that's, you know, I would say it's one of the number one issues for that. Jeff Sparrow, a left-wing author, after quoting from the same book that I just read from, pointed to the case of Scott McIntyre, who people might remember a couple of years ago, the SBS football journalist who lost his job after putting out tweets that described the atomic bombs dropped on Japan as the largest single-day terrorist attack in history and decrying widespread rape and theft by Anzac soldiers. Both, by the way, pretty much, you know, incontrovertible statements of fact. And Jeff wrote, "No one suggested McIntyre's thoughts on military history bore any relationship to his ability to report on soccer matches. He was sacked purely and simply because he voiced the wrong opinion about Anzac Day. How, then, do we describe the status of Anzac in Australia other than as political correctness? Isn't this a huge bureaucratic infrastructure designed to enforce a certain point of view, precisely what conservatives say they decry? Where, then, is the outrage when every year the lifestyle cops and the word police find some luckless individual who offends against the PC version of Anzac Day and do whatever they can to punish him or her?" Now, the thing is, though, and Jeff would probably agree with this, that it's pretty self-evident that the promotion of Anzac, the Anzac myth, isn't in reality political correctness in the way that it's understood in contemporary society at all. It's something much more mundane than that. It's capitalist ideology, or more precisely, it's a capitalist ideological crusade. But as soon as I think you highlight the hypocrisy of the right on these questions, who claim that they're against, you know, they're against censorship, that they're for free speech, that say they're against the elite institutions of society, you know, pushing propaganda down people's throat. And yet, you know, even the most mildest criticism of Anzac Day creates hysterical demands for people to lose their jobs, be driven out of the country, and so on. It really exposes that the whole agenda of anti-political correctness is itself a cynical and far-reaching ideological crusade by the really powerful elite in our society and against the victims of oppression and the mass of people. Because the most obvious thing to do is to just consider who the people leading the campaign against political correctness are. In the media, the number one outlet in Australia and really around the world promoting it is the Murdoch Press, who have article after article after article, you know, explaining how political correctness has gone mad and we're controlled by, you know, all these people pushing propaganda down our throats. Now, it's bad enough when it's the Courier Mail and the Herald Sun and so on who do that, because they might be populist in their orientation, but, you know, they're the outlet of the most, you know, powerful media empire in the world. But to make it even more ironic, actually, the publication that is the most vociferous in denouncing political correctness and the out-of-touch elites is, in fact, the Australian newspaper, which is not just a Murdoch newspaper, but is a newspaper that is read exclusively by the elites, except for the ones maybe they leave around in airport lounges, has a tiny circulation, and really is only maintained by Murdoch, despite the fact that it loses millions of dollars every year, is only maintained by Murdoch so that he can use it as a weapon to influence the actual political elites, the policy makers, the people in the political class, the rest of the media and so on. That is what the Australian newspaper is there to do. It is the most elite institution, or one of the most elite institutions, or definitely the media, in this country, and yet its entire positioning is to say that it's railing against politically correct elites. But it's not just the Murdoch press. The Liberal Party, of course, as people will know, is the other main source, the main source in the political sphere of campaigning against political correctness. And as people know, it's the party of big cap, not just of big capital in that it represents corporate interests. It's also the people who the overwhelming majority of rich voters vote for, the Liberal Party. So, you know, whether you're talking about it you know, socially, culturally or educationally, it's the same, because that's the other thing that the anti-political correct campaign goes on about, is that, oh, well, everyone who's all political correctness and everyone who is politically correct, this is centred in the universities. Well, the reality is that far from the universities being a bastion of left-wing culture, actually, even if you leave aside the way they've been marketised and deregulated and all of those things, actually, if you look at the statistics of the correlation between voting and education, actually, it's university-educated people who are overwhelmingly the most likely to vote for the Liberal Party and, you know, hold reactionary social opinions. So, really, the great achievement of the campaign against political correctness has been to establish in the minds of many that the political straitjacket put on ordinary people expressing their views is not actually just regular old capitalist propaganda of the mass media telling us that capitalism is the only way to run our lives. It's the left that's doing this, a left-wing elite that are the real elite, even though they don't have any actual power, and that they control our country. Okay, so I want to talk about where this political correctness stuff came from in the first place. It has its origins not in the right, actually, but in the left. Political correctness was originally a slur, is maybe too strong, a put-down, a semi-joking put-down, I suppose, of leftists by other leftists that emerged in, you know, some of the Maoists used to use versions of it in the 1970s. Moira Weigel talked, though, about after that, in the 1980s. Sure, she said, until the late 1980s, political correctness was used exclusively within the left and always ironically as a critique of excessive orthodoxy. In fact, some of the first people to organise against political correctness were a group of feminists who called themselves the Lesbian Sex Mafia. In 1982, they held what sounded like quite a colourful speak-out on politically incorrect sex at a theatre in New York's East Village, which is a rally against fellow feminists who'd condemned pornography and BDSM. Another writer, Jeff Chang, talks about how by the end of the 1980s, the activists he knew around San Francisco used the phrase political correctness in, quote, a jokey way, a way for one sectarian to dismiss another's sectarian line. And Jesse Walker made the same point, noting that American radicals used politically correct as an unkind term for leftists who acted as though good politics was simply a matter of mastering the right jargon. And people, you know, who are from within the left can be familiar. That is a genuine problem that exists on the left, and you can see why people would use politically correct in that way. But what happened was at the start of the 1990s, the whole concept of political correctness was adopted by the right in the United States as their latest weapon in the war on what they saw as a radical takeover of university campuses. So on the 28th of October 1990, Richard Bernstein published an article in the New York Times titled The Rising Hegemony of the Politically Correct. And I'll just read out the first paragraph of that. He said, across the country, the term PC, as it's commonly abbreviated, is being heard more and more in debates over what should be taught at universities. There are even initials, PCP, to designate a politically correct person. And though the terms are not used in utter seriousness, even by the PCPs themselves, there is a large body of belief in academia and elsewhere that a cluster of opinions about race, ecology, feminism, culture and foreign policy defines a kind of correct attitude towards the problems of the world, a sort of unofficial ideology of the university. Now, this was based on, you know, one or two examples, and in reality had some basis in reality of what happened in some university departments, but basically was completely overblown. But one of the most notable things about it was that in this early phase, it had none of the anti-elitism that it's later come to be associated with, anti-political correctness has come to be associated with. Actually, it was an ultra-elitist defence of the establishment, of the university establishment, and the traditions of the canon in literature departments and so on. So the kind of things that the opponents of political correctness railed against was, we're not allowed to read the classics anymore in universities unless we deconstruct them. No one's allowed to read Shakespeare. People now do PhDs on, you know, the race politics of Bugs Bunny instead of more lofty areas of study that are more appropriate for elite institutions and the elite minds that go to universities. So that was initially, it was nothing at all to do with being anti-elitist or standing up for the poor. It was actually defending the privilege the old academic tradition dominated by stuffy, old white men. But as the Republican Party and right-wing ideologues started to take this up, it more and more lost that initial focus, and much more came to mean ordinary people can't say what they think because the left-wing thought police knocked them over the head. And it really became, in the early 1990s, opposing political correctness became a key tool used by the Republican Party in their war against the more liberal Democrats. Okay, in Australia, the campaign against political correctness came to the fore somewhat later. It was around in the early 1990s, partly through US cultural influence, but mostly the kind of thing, it was sort of fairly harmless version of it. Like, one of the iterations, not directly political correctness, was the idea of the snag men. I don't know if anyone here is old enough to remember, sensitive new age guys, basically, effete men who, didn't call women bitches and were generally not sexist pigs or racists, and it was sort of derided, for that. That's long past. But it didn't have the same viciousness to it. My auntie, for example, who's quite, left-wing, working-class person, supports refugees and so on, and she sort of wanted to be politically correct. There was this idea around, well, that's good to be politically correct, you don't want to sort of be politically incorrect. So I remember her saying to me, oh, Corey, I know it's not really PC to think this, but I just, like, the vegans who won't eat eggs, it just seems crazy to me, but, can you sort of tell me how I can wrap my head around this sort of issue? So it wasn't seen as just, what it is today. In terms of how it's used by Trump and so on, which I'll come back to. What really happened, though, was from the mid-90s onwards, the beginnings of a weaponisation of the idea of political correctness to benefit the right. Now, the reason, I'll get to how it happened in a minute, but the reason that it was able to be effective in Australia, and it has parallels around the world, the reason why people could be suspicious of political correctness, I think, has a lot to do with the Hawke Keating years of Labor government in the 1980s and into the mid 1990s. Paul Keating, and him in particular, put himself up both when he was treasurer, but also then as prime minister, as being a progressive, modernising liberal, sympathetic to Indigenous people, to women, and anti-racist, and so on. Now, the Labor Party's policies at the time didn't necessarily reflect that, but that was definitely the image that Keating and so on wanted to put forward about a modern Australia that was, over the monarchy, wanted to change the flag. Like, God, you think today the idea that we could change the bloody flag? Well, this was something that was seen as, that Paul Keating was building a consensus around the idea of reconciliation with Indigenous people, a whole series of things like that that was seen as being, mainstream Labor politics. Keating was on the right, if people remember. But at the same time that they had that sort of image, The Hawke Keating governments also presided over an economic transformation of Australia that was absolutely disastrous for trade unions and for workers, smashing living standards and eventually giving us what Keating memorably called the recession that we have to have, or we have to have. So, you know, privatisation, deregulation, dismantling of union power, a huge transfer of wealth from working class people to the rich, all the policies that we now know as neoliberalism, then we called it economic rationalism back then, all of those were implemented by the Labor Party at the same time that they were progressing, putting forward this somewhat progressive social image. And this, the economic policies, tax on workers, and then the impact of the recession, high unemployment and so on, and the fact the Labor Party was responsible for all of these things, meant that Australians were famously by 1996 waiting with baseball bats to knock out the Labor government. But because the only real alternative at the time was the Liberal Party, and the Liberal Party were for economic rationalism 100% with Labor, 100% plus a little bit more, the outlet in terms of who can be blamed for all this, or how can an ideological construct be made that can blame someone for this, was much more to target social what I'd call social progressivism from above. You know, the reason that our lives are crap is because we have to give Indigenous welcomes, or we're talking about reconciliation, or we're not allowed to say what we really think about women. That's why we hate society so much. Now, there were two people who took advantage of what I think was the ground created by the Labor government. And really, they're the two right-wing warriors most associated with campaigning against political correctness. That is, of course, Pauline Hanson and the then Prime Minister from 1996 onwards, John Howard. And between them, I think they were the two most important figures in recent Australian history in winding back the modernising, broadly social liberal consensus that came out of the end of the 1970s, the Whitlam government, and the struggles of that time, and so on. And they did it. They sort of had a team approach in a way. Whether they exactly how much, they didn't like each other in reality, because Hanson was a threat to Howard electorally. But in terms of how the assault on political correctness came into Australian politics, basically it was on the one hand Hanson, as in her famous speech in when she got into Parliament after the 1996 election, where she said we're being swamped by Asians, and openly came out saying all the vile, racist, sexist, bigoted things that, she said, oh, people won't let us say this anymore. So she did that on the one hand, came out and said all this stuff, and Howard didn't come out and say any of it. He pulled way back from the sort of open anti-Asian racism he'd had in an earlier period. But all what he did was get up and say, oh, well, I don't agree with Pauline Hanson, but, political correctness is a real problem. People feel like they can't speak up and have their say. That was how Howard did it, which both, protected him from, the accusations of racism to a certain extent, but also, sent a dog whistle to the right-wingers that secretly he really did agree with what Hanson was saying about race. And between them, I think what they did, and it wasn't just about political correctness, was really established a new framework in Australian politics when, the previous understanding of, the divisions of class and so on was essentially the division was between, workers on the one hand and the rich on the other, and that was represented by the Labor Party representing workers and the Liberal Party representing the rich and the middle class. To a new framework that I said at the beginning, whereby workers, and it was Howard's battlers they were called here, were conservative, backed the Liberals, weren't interested in trade unions anymore, and so on. And the only people, the left, was redefined from being the trade union movement to all that's associated with that, to being well-off university students, academics, and cultural commentators. And so on. And that really, a whole series of ways seeped into the body politic that, to an extent today, pretty much everyone accepts it. Now, I don't think it was inevitable that that new framework could become established just because Howard and Hanson wanted to do it. Actually, there's a couple of instances from that formative period that show how things could have been very different. One of them, the first one, was the MUA dispute in 1998. Where I won't go into the dispute, people don't know, a huge battle on the wharves, basically, between the MUA and Patrick's, that drew in, you know, the government on the side of the company and, you know, the whole massive mobilisation of the union movement. A huge class battle that went on week after week after week and saw thousands of people going down to the docks to join the pickets and so on. This, 2 years after Hanson's got into power, completely sidelined Hanson and completely reshaped how politics was talked about. Because one of the other things that was part of the reframing of the debate was about, oh, well, there's no class struggle anymore. You know, unions aren't, there's no battle between labour and capital. That's all sort of ancient stuff from the 1950s and 60s that's not really relevant to modern life. Well, the MUA dispute transformed that and put where do you stand on union rights, where do you stand on the class struggle, it's bosses versus workers, back at the centre of Australian politics for some period of time. Now, that dispute ended in a stalemate and not great advance to the left, and so, you know, things went back over time. But the other example of how things could have been different from that period is the anti-corporate movement, the anti-capitalist globalisation movement that took place around the world at the end of the 1990s. And again, you know, it was in the context of Howard's the Prime Minister and Hanson and all that sort of stuff, but then for a brief period around when we had S11 here, they were totally marginalised. What happened at S11 was that 20,000 people blockaded the Crown Casino just down the road, which way we're facing here, in Melbourne, to blockade a meeting of the World Economic Forum, basically a meeting of the rich and powerful. It was part of a global movement that basically targeted the rich as, you know, the enemy, as the main problem in the world, and was, you know, inherently, I think, an internationalist movement, an anti-racist movement, and, you know, and saw corporations as the problem. A lot of the issues about globalisation and so on that Hanson actually raised herself were brought up there, but in a left-wing framework. And Hanson tried to relate to it actually briefly, but was totally marginal to it. So it was about fighting economic injustice, but also standing up against oppression in various ways. And you know, for a whole series of months, while this was the main issue of debate, that and the fallout from it, that Hanson was totally marginal. So they were two really important examples that I think point to why it is that political correctness or the campaign against it has got such a hold over the last 20 years or so, which is that there's been very few outbreaks of that kind. That's the weakness in the class struggle on our side. The lack of trade union picket lines and strikes and so on all allows for the right to fill the vacuum with this framework. Okay, so 9/11, the attack on the World Trade Centers and so on, the Twin Towers, on one level intensified racism and reaction around the world, and hostility towards Muslims a big part of it. Actually, though, in the years after 9/11 and through the wars, political correctness, while still around as an issue, was much more on the back burner than it had been in the 1990s. Since Trump was elected, or really since about 2015, as we sort of started to see the emergence of the far right in the United States, it's very much come back to the fore in terms of a right-wing talking point. And I think in Australia, It's been there as an ongoing issue, and you can see it in the battle between Labor and the Greens, which very much accepts this new framework that you have, the gentrified inner cities where university-educated rich people supposedly live, and they're interested in refugees, not interested in class issues, and then you've got all the the blue-collar areas that vote Labor, and Labor can't possibly say a word in support of refugees because all of these totally conservative white workers will revolt and join the Liberal Party. So, that's been how it's kept alive in Australia, even though political correctness itself has only more recently come back to the fore. Okay. So I've mostly pointed at this in terms of the right being to blame for these problems. But I think it's clearly not just the right. The left, or what passes for the left in Australia, and how it's evolved and the conception of the left has evolved, has also played a major part. In explaining this, Jeff Sparrow, in a book that's not published yet but that's going to be out soon, talks about the changes in the social movement generation, so-called, of student activists that emerged in the 60s and 70s, and comes up with a framework which he basically says that there are three periods of time for these activists. The first of it was transformationist, the second one was consolidationist, and the third was despairist. And what he basically meant by that was that in the 1970s, or in the 1960s, you had a new generation of radical students on the university campuses who wanted to have a transformationist attitude to politics, to liberate women and gay people, to end the war in Vietnam and overthrow capitalism, and to link up with all the other different social struggles that were happening. And that meant linking up with the working class movement as the key agent that could actually transform society. So he says, well, that happened. But then by the mid-1970s, the high point of that struggle had ebbed away, and a lot of these student activists, particularly the leaders of them, moved into what he called the consolidationist phase. And I'll read out what he says by this. He says, by the 1980s, university activists often possessed sufficient influence to deploy mechanisms of the university to implement their projects. They were less inclined to call upon a community that might not respond. They were more inclined to push a proposal through a curriculum review board. The relative seniority that some had obtained came with a certain institutional power which they began to use. And then he says, the consolidationist methodology, changing a policy from above and then relying on official channels to enforce it, could and sometimes did, particularly in later years, entail an implicit reliance on state power. That meant progressives didn't have to convince ordinary people to embrace their ideas. Worse still, it also associated those ideas with a state and state-like bodies that many ordinary people instinctively mistrusted. And I think that's a reasonable approximation of what happened to some of the people who'd been the leaders of various social movements in the 60s and 70s and then moved into essentially jobs in various government set-up structures that continued that project. The third phase that Jeff described as despairism took place around the turn of the century and is about the process of, in the 1980s and in the 1990s, these people were taking jobs, setting up structures, outlawing, sexist language in books and so on. And that was separated off from any idea of mass struggle, but it wasn't necessarily, didn't see itself as counterposed to the opinions of the masses of people. It was more just doing things on their behalf. Well, after the rise of Hansen, and particularly after things like the Iraq War happened, particularly in Australia, the government campaigning and winning support for its appalling policies on refugees, these people turned from being sort of having a patronising attitude to the masses to having an attitude of utter contempt for the mass of people. So you think of things like Michael Moore's book, people might have heard of, called Stupid White Men, which is extremely popular around the time of the Iraq War, and that fitted in with a whole idea that the reason that the right wing, whether it be George Bush or John Howard, could get away with what they did was because ordinary people are stupid, they're inherently conservative, they're right wing, they've got no sympathy or empathy for the plight of refugees or Muslims or whatever it is. And that became an actually anti-ordinary people attitude from a whole section of what I would say was by then no longer the left, but simply the liberal intelligentsia. And that's been massively exacerbated over the last few years by Brexit, Trump, and so on. Okay. So I think Jeff's framework is sort of an interesting one and useful, but I think it misses out a central aspect, which is not about what happened to the generation of radical students who got integrated into governments and university positions and so on, but much more fundamentally was that the reason that they were able to be seen and see themselves as the representatives of left-wing opinion was precisely because of the decline of any genuine left based in the working class movement. And that's about talking about the decline of the Communist Party, which declined for its own reasons, and the decline of the huge struggles that took place in the 1960s and 70s. Things like the Clary O'Shea strike that shut down the country in defence of a union leader who'd been jailed. Actually, those kind of things were seen as being this is what the left is. And the decline of that, the defeat, as I mentioned, the Hawke-Keating governments, the defeat of the trade unions in that, the accord that led to the absolute decimation of trade unionism in Australia, I think all those are the fundamental things. They're about the erosion of a real left that led essentially for liberalism now to be substituted. People think, say, left-wing and liberalism mean the same thing, when in fact they're completely different. Okay. Okay. Trump has really transformed anti-political correctness, or the campaign against political correctness on the right, when you compare it with what John Howard and Pauline Hanson did. The traditional strategy of the right was to basically enable the far-right racists, to enable the likes of Hanson. So John Howard, you know, once he got into office anyway, never said any of the things that Hanson said. Well, Trump's the opposite. Trump embodies both in the same. He wants to say, you know, the most sexist, vile, racist things himself, and then he invokes political correctness himself in his own defence. And you're starting to see that much more here in Australia as well, the likes of Tony Abbott, Peter Dutton, and so on. The real equivalent of Howard today is Malcolm Turnbull, who's the one who gets up and when Peter Dutton says something vile and racist, he says, oh, well, you know, political correctness is a big problem and people should be able to say what they think. But, you know, Turnbull is no Howard in the sense that he's disregarded as an idiot for saying this and a pawn of the right, whereas when Howard did it, he was seen as the master political manipulator, which, in a way, he was. The other thing about the evolution of political correctness is that it's moved very far away from anything to do with policing language or, you know, the need to do Indigenous welcomes or, you know, the history wars and so on. Attacking political correctness now is basically just attacking anything that you don't like. So you think of Black Lives Matter campaign is seen as being, this is politically correct, Black Lives Matter, because you won't say all lives matter. Well, what that actually has to do with political correctness is beyond me. Or most instructively, Tony Abbott, at the end of last year, when the marriage equality campaign was going to the referendum, or whatever it was, he says, if you're against political correctness, you should vote no. Like, it's not about, you know, anything to do with language, or it's basically just, if you're bigoted against gays, you should vote no. That's essentially what he was saying. So it's now just, political correctness is just a word for if you don't like anything that's left-wing or progressive. It's lost a lot of its connotations about the left dominating the discourse and so on, although that's clearly still there. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to leave that. I was going to say a bit about, there's clearly are things that the left do, and, you know, liberals do, and so on, that give ammunition to the right. But I think this is massively more the case in the United States. All the stuff about trigger warnings and all those sort of things are massively more, wide-scale things than they are here in Australia, where it's really pretty marginal. The attempts, things that are claimed to be politically correct, there's hardly any of them, really. Okay, so I'll finish up by just saying what attitude we should have to all this. Well, I think it's important that socialists defend the use of things like anti-sexist language. We do want to challenge the traditional history of Australia that says it's a settlement rather than invasion. These are actually points that the left doesn't want to duck in any sense of the word. We do want to tear down all the racist statues that are dotted around this country in tribute to the colonisers. But I think it's important that we don't want to do this by appealing to the institutions of the legal system to do it on our behalf. And I think as well, one of the main things that is problematic is when the left puts getting the terms right above getting the politics right. So basically, in my view, if someone comes up to us and says, I think Donald Trump's a cunt, well, our response should not be to have a discussion about sexist language, but to say, yeah, I agree with you, he's a bastard. I think that's an important part about how the left positions itself. And I think the other thing is about not allowing us to be wedged into putting issues of so-called political correctness above class issues and be seen to just talk about social issues. But I think fundamentally, though, there's two things that are necessary to happen to change, I suppose, the framework in which politics is talked about and to make it harder for the right to set up this idea that they're heroes of the outsiders against political correctness. One of them is the union movement has to be rebuilt. I think the single biggest reason that the right can get away with the absolute garbage that the Murdoch press are standing up for the downtrodden is for actually workers to start organising and going on strike and fighting back. Because tell you what, when that happens, the Murdoch press aren't going to be championing themselves or putting themselves forward as the champions of the downtrodden oppressed fighting back against the elite anymore. They are going to be on the side of the elite as they were in the MUA dispute in 1998 and as they are every time there's a battle between Labor and capital. So I think Now, that's the real fundamental problem in society. But as well, I think it's about building up and rebuilding socialist organisation. Because I think if you look at what's cut through against the political correctness narrative internationally, the two figures that stand out are Corbyn and Sanders. That they ran a campaign on economic issues that related to people's hatred of the rich, hatred of the big banks, hatred of the political system and the government and so on economic grounds, but also were prepared to, Sanders less than Corbyn, to champion progressive social issues as well, and say that these are linked things. And that's what the big problem here is, where you've got the Labor and the Greens as the two variants of left politics. Well, it's an absolutely no-win situation, that neither of those give any road forward for the left and any chance of actually rebuilding what was once the ABC of people's political understanding of left and right, that left-wing people and socialist movements are about organising the struggles of workers, organising a working-class fight back, resisting the rich, and resisting everything that the rich and powerful and their media apparatus do to divide us, which is scapegoat refugees and other ethnic minorities to turn us against each other, turn us men against women, black against white, gay against straight, and so on. That the left is about overcoming those divisions and building a united fight back against the powerful. Well, I don't think Greens politics can ever do that because they couldn't give a fuck about the working class, and Labor politics can't do it palpably because they both screw over the working class economically and go along with all the reactionary racism of the right. So I think in terms of a fight against the use of political correctness against us, those two things, rebuilding the union movement, rebuilding the socialist movement, are crucial. But we also need to take account of the ways that the right uses it, the problems the left can fall into, and how we can combat that as well in the shorter term.